Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of October 14th, 2016. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Very well, very well. Well, D.R., October, so I'm a physicist. Let's start out with that. That's what I was trained as. Every October, there was a little bit of buzz in the physics department because the Nobel Prizes were awarded. And there was always a physics guy that got the Nobel Prize. This year, we've had some interesting Nobel Prizes. One in the economics regime was awarded to two guys from Boston, right? A guy from Harvard, a guy from MIT. And they got awarded a prize for this esoteric thing called contract theory. And I guess contract theory has something to do with designing contracts so that everyone has an incentive to participate in the contract. There's a win-win.
Yes.
And I was racking my brains to come up with a climate connection, but I couldn't. I Googled it. I mean, it seems obvious that within the climate context, there has to be some way that the agreements have to, the contracts that are made have to pay off everyone. Anyway, I couldn't find it. If anyone out there in podcast land knows a connection between contract theory and climate change, please let us know.
Well, I have a theory on that, the efforts to put a price on carbon in a way that's setting a contract in which you agree to protect future generations.
Well, there you go. And so how does the future generation, what's the incentive to the future generation to, since they're not around yet, to fulfill their terms of the contract?
Well, I guess perhaps it's a one-sided deal in the sense that this generation is recognizing the moral obligation of protecting future generations.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And making sure that that a healthy planet that we have is turned over to the next generation.
And I agree. I agree. And I guess the other – so let me go to the other interesting Nobel Prize awarded this week. And the second Nobel Prize was in arts and literature, I guess. Mm-hmm. And curiously enough, it went to this guy – I don't know if you ever heard of him. He's kind of a Rolling Stone. You might not have pinned him down anywhere, but it's a guy named Bob Dylan. Have you ever heard of Bob Dylan, D.R.?
Yes, definitely. And even though I was born after he first became popular, I've definitely enjoyed a lot of his music. It's interesting that his win occurs 9 years to the week after Al Gore won the Nobel Peace Prize, and you sort of see the same sort of cultural forces that complain about Gore's winning complaining now online about Bob Dylan winning. I guess I guess you can say that Gore and Dylan are hated for the same reason, that they're both truth tellers. They're both willing to stand up and express support for sometimes unpopular opinions, and they're both willing to essentially, recognize the importance of art and the importance of creativity and the importance of thinking about the future.
Yeah, I think that it is a fascinating thing, because if you take Dylan's words, the lyrics, and just print them on a page, it looks a heck of a lot like a poem, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's not at all unreasonable. But I guess the thing I wanted to point out was that I went and Googled it, and it turns out that Bob Dylan's song, now there are many famous songs, and if you're so young that you don't know who Bob Dylan is, I'll tell you to go Google Like a Rolling Stone and stuff like that. And the famous phrase about you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind is blowing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, his song called A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall was actually chosen as the anthem for the Copenhagen climate talks in 2009, which struck me as remarkable. That and if you look at the lyrics, I mean, they really have some profoundly climate. Of course, it wasn't consciously climate, but he's got, I've stepped in the middle of seven sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. It's stuff like that is in here. And I guess the question comes, is it legitimate to repurpose something like Bob Dylan's songs from the 60s to new new interpretations.
I certainly think it is. I mean, music can have a lot of different interpretations. And certainly, you know, if you think about all the controversies about when certain politicians try to seize songs that are written by people who don't agree with the political views of those artists, you know, think of that controversy over the attempted distortion of the song Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen, and how people deliberately tried to misinterpret the meaning and the purpose of that song. So obviously, you know, when musical lyrics are respected, they can apply to, you know, themes that are generally supported by the artists. And obviously, you know, Dylan is a sensible and wise man, and obviously he recognizes the need to protect the future.
Right. Well, it's funny, on the way home, I was listening in the car, and there was a report on Dylan, and they quoted the song Like a Rolling Stone. And, of course, mm-hmm. the chorus in that is, "You're invisible now, you've got nothing to conceal," right? Mm-hmm. And the guy said, "Isn't that just like the Internet? Yeah. You're invisible on the Internet, but you have no secrets." Mm-hmm. I said, wow, if he can do it, then I can reinterpret Hard Rain Gonna Fall as a climate song.
Exactly.
Anyway, congratulations to Bob Dylan, who's been crooning around for a long time now. Now he's a Nobel Prize winner. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Good for him.
I believe so.
Good for him. I mean, quite the achievement.
Mm-hmm.
So the news just keeps bopping along, and it's stuff that seems to be not related to climate stuff, but it's in fact it is. So mm-hmm. you have a smartphone, don't you?
Yes.
In fact, I have an iPhone, as it happens, in probably at this point an ancient iPhone, mm-hmm. but an iPhone nonetheless. We all know about the debacle at Samsung, where the battery started catching fire, mm-hmm. and they did a recall, and they were going to fix it. They said, "Oh, we had a bad component maker," and they fixed it and started sending out the cell phones a second time, and the second time they all caught fire. Right? Did mm-hmm. you see that?
Yes, yes. It gives new meaning to the term burner phones. And
oh, my God. Anyway, okay, so keep going after that.
and yes, Samsung has announced that they're basically going to end the production of the Galaxy Note 7 smartphone after the constant controversies surrounding the incendiary nature of the phones. I guess the Note 7 is now
the
new Coke of our time, or the Crystal Pepsi of our time, to think of other, you know, failed marketing ventures.
Well, I guess it's very interesting, and I heard a report earlier today that sort of clicked for me, and what they were saying was that the real culprit in the whole Samsung thing is that there is a fierce drive to make smaller batteries with more and more power, right? Mm-hmm. So if you try and categorize batteries, they talk about the battery, the volumetric power of the battery, and the gravimetric. So really, they want to know how big is it and how much does it weigh, the battery, mm-hmm. right? And of course, in a cell phone, there's this huge pressure to make a smaller, lighter, tiny battery with lots and lots more power, electricity in it, I mean, basically energy. And mm-hmm. one of the guys in the report said, "Oh yeah, basically you're making a small bomb. The more mm-hmm. you work at it, it's a little explosive. It's a compact thing with a lot of energy in it." And of course, that clicks right into the whole question of stored energy at the electrical grid scale, right? Mm-hmm. We've talked endlessly about how battery development will allow windmills to store power. We have Elon Musk selling batteries on the wall. I mean, mm-hmm. I guess it cuts two ways. One is that we're getting improvements in batteries, but the other is that it's not without a little bit of risk. I mean, this is a high technology, and people are really pushing the boundaries, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you Definitely. See anything on that?
Definitely. And in some of the coverage of the Samsung issue, you see people in the comment sections of these stories basically saying that, you know, if something like this happened on a widespread scale with electric vehicle batteries, that would be an unfortunate win for the fossil fuel industry. Although I would argue that if you think about it in terms of things that explode, look at all those oil tankers that explode.
Yeah.
I think those are much bigger risks than electric batteries causing problems. I mean, just because Samsung had their design issues doesn't mean that the makers of electric vehicles are necessarily going to have similar issues with their batteries. And I would argue that it's probably still safer to drive an electric vehicle with a battery than to rely upon a car that needs you know, gas that comes from an oil tanker that blows up and burns up a forest.
Well, and they said that it gets a lot of press. It's not clear to me how many Samsung 7s actually caught fire, right? Enough to be in the news, but they probably sold millions and millions of them by the time they figured out that there was a problem. So you're right. Somebody was saying you're more likely to get hit by lightning than to have your cell phone blow up. But it is.
Although I do have to note the irony that, this is happening to Samsung phones and not to iPhones, despite the fact that Apple is run by a guy named Tim Cook.
Well, you could cook a battery on that. Cook an egg on that phone. Well, it's somewhere. This is now not climate related, but somehow Google released their own phone, the Pixel, right? And what more perfect timing could Google have had than to step into the market when Samsung is, self-immolating over their battery? I mean, it's just interesting. But from a climate perspective, the question of the steady progress of batteries, and this is sort of a little flutter of angels' wings that, there might be some hiccups along the way, but we need to keep pressing that technology forward, right?
Mm-hmm. We didn't stop going to the moon just because, you had the Gus Grissom incident in 1967. As unfortunate and tragic as it was, we still pressed on, and we still innovated, again. We've had tragedies. We had Challenger. We've had other tragedies, but we still pursued going to the moon, exploring beyond our Earth, And just because people might seize upon certain issues with electric vehicles doesn't mean that we shouldn't continue pursuing the necessary, noble, and moral venture of getting off fossil fuels in terms of transportation.
Well said. Well said, dear. So speaking of trying to get off fossil fuels, here is my flight of fancy for the week. Here's where the airplane heads down the runway and all the Galaxy 7 smartphones have been turned off as it takes off into the air. But I saw an article that said, how can we ever pay for all of the technological development and changes that must take place if we're truly going to move to a clean energy economy? And the article said, oh, it's easy. It's easy. Half of the U.S. federal budget, have $1 trillion is spent in the military, and that you could go into that bucket of money and find lots of places to transfer that money to clean energy. And why the heck not? So is that a crazy idea, DR?
Not a bad idea at all. I mean, the military does recognize the need to sort of reduce carbon pollution. So why not, put the money where the mouth is, so to speak?
Well, it's funny you should say that now that because one of the other things that dropped out for me is that people have heard about the military-industrial complex, which, of course, Dwight Eisenhower warned us against in 1959 when he left. Mm-hmm. And the military-industrial complex is not just a phrase. What it means is that the military grants huge contracts, multi-billion, trillion-dollar contracts to industry. What does industry do? Industry turns around and puts a little tiny bit of that contract into every congressional district so that no congressman can vote against that stupid airplane because there's a job in his district, right? And it's a very smart thing, but it builds into the system this thing where everyone's getting paid and the money that gets sent to the Defense Department then goes its way back and gets into everybody's district. And even Barney Frank, who is not a stupid guy, would be fighting in favor of the jet engine they were making up in Lynn because there were jobs there, right? He had to protect that. Mm-hmm. I suppose as the we should be encouraging the Defense Department, if it's going to develop clean energy, to spread those jobs around through every district so that there are votes behind to maintain that effort, right?
Exactly. It's clean energy is going to be the job creator of the remainder of this century going on to remainder of this decade going on to decades going forward. Mm-hmm. So obviously it makes strategic sense for the Defense Department to do that because people are not going to turn down jobs, especially jobs that provide a stable and healthy future.
Yeah. So it's kind of a kooky idea because it's like tilting at windmills to complain about the Defense Department budget, but there are maybe we can use it. But let me go one step further. So I said, okay, with all this money in the Defense Department, but let's think for a minute about the following concept, which has floated around for a while, which is I'm not sure the exact words. It's a universal basic income. Basically, the idea that as a society have more and more jobs taken over by computers, there are fewer and fewer people that are actually needed to make things. So why should we hold that against those everyone that there are simply no jobs, and that this concept of a basic income for all Americans is a way to alleviate poverty and basically address sort of inequality and the fact that the jobs, I mean, the ultimate vision of the sort of computer future is to have very few people actually doing any work, right? So have you ever heard of that concept?
Yes, it's also known as guaranteed minimum income. It's attracted the support of economists across both the ideological spectrum, across the right and the left. And it certainly would make sense when you think about all the controversy surrounding the so-called gig economy, and you know the pressures that people feel to participate in that in the so-called gig economy. Having a universal basic income or guaranteed minimum income would certainly alleviate those sorts of pressures, I would think.
And so here's the kicker. Here's the last domino that falls in that idea. If you had a carbon tax that was uniformly distributed to all American citizens, everyone would get a certain amount of money every month. So you would have the beginnings of a universal income that was fairly distributed. It's essentially an anti-poverty program because you're giving cash to people who need it the most. And isn't that another justification for a carbon tax above and beyond the obvious climate implications? But it has this other effect that it allows you to address poverty in a way that has, through this universal minimum income, basically has some intellectual heft to it, right?
Definitely, it would be an effective way to reduce poverty, and it would be a very, very effective way to reduce emissions as well. It would just be, as Thomas Friedman once said, a win-win-win-win.
Yes, exactly. Well, I guess, you know, I'm not going to hold my breath until all this happens, but until you begin to enunciate it and say that these things are at least possible, right, it is never going to happen. But I think the carbon tax idea has a lot of merit in a lot of different ways. So, well, DR, we got to leave it there. We covered way too much ground tonight, way too much, I don't know, flights of fancy, from Bob Dylan to universal minimum income. Wow.
Exactly.
So what we'll do is we'll put up links to some of the crazy stuff we talked about at massclimateaction.org/blog. Please take a look if you want to find out any background. Of course, you can find us on Facebook at /massclimateaction. You can listen to us on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio. You can find us on SoundCloud. You can find us on iTunes. Just search for Massachusetts Climate Action. So we'll close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. So, DR, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll see you all rolling on down the road like a rolling stone. Bye-bye, everybody. Take care.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.